Well, good morning, everyone. Welcome to the 7th Annual Ohio Chapters Conference of the Federalist Society. I'm Patrick Lewis, president of the Cleveland Chapter and a member of our planning committee. First of all, let me thank all of you for joining us. This conference has been an enduring success for the Federalist Society in Ohio and around the country, and it's because of everyone in this room and all the dedication you show to the Federalist Society coming out to our events, supporting the organization. We're so happy to have all of you here this morning. I also want to extend a shout out to FedSox Lawyers Division team. I know Lisa Ezel, Claire Nalepa, Hannah Kanasik, and Abby Kipto are here, and I believe some others as well. And thanks to all of you for all that you've done to plan and support this event and many others like it all around the country. We have some great panels today. We will be kicking off our Ohio Supreme Court panel here momentarily, and we have two afternoon panels, Beyond Universities, the Impact of Students for Fair Admissions in the Workplace, and Saying What the Law Is, Applying Ohio's Abortion Amendment. We also have our luncheon that will take place immediately following the Supreme Court panel, featuring an important keynote address by Judge David Strauss of the United States Court of Appeals for the 8th Circuit, titled, What My Grandparents' Experiences in the Holocaust Taught Me About the First Amendment. Before I introduce our moderator, I just want to go over a couple quick housekeeping items. First, if entering or exiting, please use obviously the back entrances. Please try to be as quiet as possible. I know that the doors can get a little loud. Second, for those of you who are interested in CLE credit, please scan the QR code located on the back of your pamphlet. Do note that our CLE accreditation application is still pending, so while we're going to have you fill out the form and collect the information, we can't issue or award CLE credit until we're approved. So our first panel today is about the Ohio Supreme Court. We are very pleased to have all six candidates for seats on the Ohio Supreme Court with us today. We pride ourselves at the Federalist Society on lively discussion and debate. However, as probably everyone in this room knows, the Federalist Society does not take positions on issues and does not endorse candidates for public office. With that, I'd like to introduce our moderator for today's event, Professor Christopher Walker, professor of law at the University of Michigan and formerly at Ohio State, where he taught for a decade. He teaches and researches on issues of administrative law, regulation, and law and policy. Professor Walker clerked for Justice Kennedy of the U.S. Supreme Court, worked on Capitol Hill, and for 4 years served on the bipartisan Judicial Advisory Commission of Senators Brown and Portman, where he helped to fill 10 federal district court vacancies in Ohio. Professor Walker, we're glad to see you back in Ohio. Thanks for coming. The floor is yours.
Well, I wanted to welcome you all to the Ohio Supreme Court Candidates Forum. It is so awesome to be back in the great state of Ohio, the home of the Buckeyes, the Bengals,
the Browns.
We'll get to the Browns. The Guardians is one that's going to trip me up, but that's a whole different panel. The Reds, Chief Judge Jeff Sutton. That was kind of where I was going with that. I'm just really, really happy to be back. So I'm excited to moderate this panel. I also just want to say at the beginning, I am just so grateful to each of you for your service and also your willingness to run. And I'm really excited about this. The format for this is we're going to give each candidate 5 to 6 minute intro, and we're keeping our time, and we've got our timekeeper right in the front. And if they want to come up to the podium, I'd say do it. If you want to sit. If you come up to the podium, I'd say bring your name tag with you just so that people can on TV can see that. And then we'll go through a moderated Q&A. I have 6 questions that I kind of randomly assigned one of them to be the first respondent to. They'll have up to two minutes to respond, the first person. And then any of the other 5 that want to jump in can have up to a minute to kind of talk about that. And then we'll go to audience Q&A. So definitely start thinking about the questions you want to ask the candidates. So we're going to start with these introductions, and we're going to start in alphabetical order. So we'll start with Justice Dieters.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you for having us here today. I'm going to assume nobody here knows me, so I'll briefly introduce myself. My name's Joe Dieters. I am an Ohio boy. I'm the oldest of eight kids. I'm Jesuit educated. Matter of fact, Pat Fisher and I went to school together. I always claim Pat cheated off me all through high school. And I went to UC, University of Cincinnati, for law school, and Pat, he went to Harvard or something like that. Anyway, my professional career has predominantly been as a county prosecutor in Cincinnati. I was also elected twice as state treasurer of Ohio. And I had a private practice for about 10 years. In that role, I actually personally settled the Opers versus Fannie Mae case about 10 years ago, a class action case for the state of Ohio. I am the new judge on the court, and it's been an interesting switch of responsibilities in some ways. And I think it's a little too early or presumptuous to define my judicial philosophy. But I can tell you this, I approach my job as simple as I approach my other jobs, and that is I am going to follow my oath. And as prosecutor, my job was to enforce the laws of the state of Ohio. I didn't have the choice of picking and choosing the laws I wanted to follow. I didn't get to say, oh, I'm not going to prosecute crimes under $1,000, theft crimes. That wasn't my job. And in my entire career, as I listened to judges campaigning for office and talking about their careers and what their role is, they always say, we're here to interpret the Constitution, not write the laws, not write the Constitution. So here's the rub I've learned very quickly. How do you define interpretation? Do you believe that the Constitution's a living document and you can decide based on your feelings, your constituents' views, how you're going to interpret it? Justice Fisher and I spent about an hour and a half in a car the other day, and I asked him, what do you think my judicial philosophy is, Pat? He said, well, you're clearly an originalist. And it's true, because I seek to determine from the text what was meant at the time it was written. And I believe firmly that to do otherwise would be blurring the lines of the separation of powers. It would create uncertainty and chaos in our democracy. Anyway, thank you for the invitation here today. I look forward to hearing from the other judges up here on the panel. And thanks for the invitation. Appreciate it.
Good morning, everyone. It's great to be here. When I first ran for the Ohio Supreme Court back in 2018, this was one of my favorite campaign spots. And it was one of my favorites because it provided me with an anecdote that I've told and retold over time. After I accepted your kind invitation to attend a candidates forum, I received this call from an operative from the state Democratic Party that heard that I had accepted this invitation and told me to call you immediately and rescind that you're not going to get a single vote in there. And my response was, have you been telling candidates this for the last 25 years? That sounds like a plan for losing votes. See, the Federalist Society to me is a very respected organization that has a valuable perspective. I have a lot of friends in the Federalist Society. So I'm going, and I didn't heed his advice, and I came here. I believe it was in the same room we're speaking in now. And it was great. You could not have been more welcoming. We had a great discussion, as I'm sure we will today. I pointed out that one of your preeminent members, Bill Otis, wrote an article that supported an effort I led in 2018 to bring more transparency to the plea bargaining process in Ohio, and I was very grateful for that. And so we had a discussion, as I'm sure we will today, about interpretation and what judges should do. You'll hear the accusation that sometimes comes up in these judicial races for years about judges shouldn't legislate from the bench. And I, of course, wholeheartedly agree with that. I take the same oath to uphold the Constitution of the United States, the state of Ohio, and the laws of this state as all my distinguished colleagues that are on this panel. So I take that very seriously. But in 2018, what I really liked is we had this discussion about judicial policy, which is different. What I saw from being a trial court judge for 14 years were the problems that you experience as litigators. So there's a lot of litigators in this room right now. And I wanted to deal with a problem of systemic delay that exists in the system. How many of you have ever had to deal with a client who's frustrated because the trial court judge, after you paid good money, or your client paid good money to you, to work up the discovery to file a motion for summary judgment, and it was timely opposed by the other side, sat there and waited for the judge to rule. As the trial date slowly was coming at you and your client was saying, hey, why isn't the judge ruling? And some of my colleagues on the bench say, hey, there's a mechanism that you can exercise if that happens to you. You could always file a writ of procedendo against the judge that you're looking for that favorable ruling. And I didn't think that was reasonable. I also didn't think it was reasonable for hardworking civil attorneys who for 2 weeks work up a case and then show up ready for trial and are told, sorry, you're not going to trial today. There's a criminal case that's going to take precedence over your case that costs thousands of dollars. So I wanted to work on, and that's what I've done since I was fortunate to gain a seat. It's been an honor and a privilege to serve you on this court. And sure enough, after that, I visited firms and I met a lot of you, and they liked what I had to say, and I gained your support. I'm very proud of that. So here we are in 2024. I still feel passionately about these issues. But what's changed? What's changed is the supermajority in the legislature has changed the rules. They've put party label on the Supreme Court races and the appellate judges, not the trial court judges, okay? And this was not supported by any bipartisan support. There was no articulated policy that I saw for changing the rules in that respect. In fact, I've been on record since 2014. We shouldn't have partisan primaries. If we're going to have an elected judiciary, we shouldn't run as Republicans or Democrats. I swear no allegiance to any political party. My allegiance is to the law and solely the law. And so I'm looking forward to the discussion today. And hopefully this will come up and what my other candidates think about this, judges running under party label and what that means and what it does to the public's perception of our jobs to be an independent jurist. So thank you very much. It's great to be back here and I look forward to the discussion.
All right, good morning. I did bring my name tag up because I am Lisa Forbes. I'm a judge on the 8th District Court of Appeals, and I am a new candidate for the Ohio Supreme Court, so Lisa Forbes. So I want to thank you all for the opportunity to be here today and to have this open discussion. I'm running for the Ohio Supreme Court because I want to do my part to make sure that the Supreme Court serves as an effective firewall to protect our democracy and the rule of law. To me, that means that when I'm on the high court, I'll be committed to improving the public's perception of the judiciary with the goal of restoring public trust and confidence in judges and the justice system as a whole. I am, and I will continue to be, committed to and focused on the safety needs of our citizens. Too many of our fellow citizens live in crisis because they're in fear for their personal safety. That needs to change. I will not tolerate public corruption. I will not turn a blind eye to illegal abuse of taxpayers. I will not support unconstitutional attempts to reduce the rights of Ohioans or to deny the history and diversity of this great state that is as American as apple pie. Ohioans will be able to count on me to protect the rights in the Constitution and in the law. I see the Ohio Supreme Court as an equal branch of government, equal to the governor, equal to the legislature. A strong and independent court, free from party-dominated politics, is essential to a fully functioning democracy. And that's what I mean when I say that I want to do my part to ensure that the High Court serves as an effective firewall to protect our democracy. So since I'm sure many of you don't really know who I am, I'd like to take a few minutes to introduce myself and tell you a little bit about my professional experience, my commitment to community, and my work ethic, all of which provide the foundation to enable me to serve as that effective firewall. My professional experience comes from the 32 years I have as a lawyer. For 27 of those years, I practiced law, handling complicated legal matters in trial courts and courts of appeals all over the state of Ohio. For the majority of that time, some 17 years, I was a partner in a national law firm headquartered right here in Columbus. I learned the skills there that are needed to that I needed to untangle the most complex of legal questions, and I learned how to explain those complicated matters to judges and juries. For the last chapter of my career, I turned my focus to public service as a judge, and I use those skills I learned in private practice every day. For my commitment to community, I'm going to give you two examples. First, for over 15 years, I have been a volunteer with an organization that is a not-for-profit social services agency that assists 15 to 20,000 Ohio citizens every year. I'm the chair of that board, and the organization, it's called the Senders, provides high-quality health care, both physical and mental health care, workforce development, early childhood education, and help for adolescents who don't have the benefit of parents to take care for them, so that those adolescents have a safe place to stay and have access to services that they desperately need. In summary, the Senders and I are committed to giving people access to opportunity and to strengthening the entire community as a whole in doing so. Second, for some 20 years, before I became a judge, I volunteered election after election to ensure the most fundamental of rights, to make sure that those fundamental rights is a reality, that every registered voter can cast a ballot and have that ballot count. And finally, for my work ethic, I learned that from my family. My grandparents are immigrants. My grandfathers were both coal miners in western Pennsylvania. As a first-generation college graduate, standing before you today as a candidate for the Ohio Supreme Court, I can fully appreciate that I am a living example of the type of opportunity that my grandparents came to America looking for. And I want to do what I can to make that opportunity available for generations to come in a thriving and vibrant democracy. As a justice, I want to bring my expertise, commitment, and work ethic to the court to stand up for all Ohioans. I will tolerate neither violent crime nor illegal corruption. I will make calls based on the law without regard to politics, family ties, or special interests. The main courtroom at the 8th District Court of Appeals, if any of you have had the benefit of being there, is just an elegant room. It's full of ornate carved wood, historical paintings, and American flags. Above the bench there is inscribed the words of John Adams, well, close to the words of John Adams, that this is a government of law and not of men. I like to say also not a government of women. And I'm running to make that aspiration a reality. I'm running for the Ohio Supreme Court to ensure that the High Court serves as an effective firewall to protect our democracy and the rule of law. Thank you, and I look forward to the question and answers to follow. Sorry about that.
You did that on purpose.
Good morning, everybody.
Pleasure to be here. My name is Judge Dan Hawkins. I'm with the Franklin County Court of Common Pleas. It's an honor to be here today. I'm also a member of the Federalist Society. I joined shortly after taking the bench, and this is one of my favorite events to attend. First, because it's literally across the street from my courthouse, so as long as it doesn't rain today, I can get back to work on time. And second, because it's a great opportunity, especially this panel, to discuss the future of our great Ohio Supreme Court. So I want to tell you a little bit more about myself, my history as a judge, and how I operate. But first, I think it's important to talk about the elephant in the room. There's certainly been a lot of controversy surrounding the Ohio Supreme Court the last few years. Some would say there's been a shadow hanging over that court. Rest assured that if I'm fortunate enough to be elected to that Ohio Supreme Court, we will lift that shadow, because once again, we will have a justice on that Ohio Supreme Court that is a graduate of The Ohio State University. I mean, we have Cleveland State, Cincinnati, Harvard. We even got a Michigan guy on the Ohio Supreme Court, but we do not have an Ohio State grad. That is a scandal. In all seriousness, I'm a Columbus kid, born and raised, and my family is a family of public servants. Come from a blue-collar, working-class family. My grandfather served in World War II. This flag I wear on my lapel every day belonged to him. He was a Marine who served World War II and was a Japanese prisoner of war, was captured in the Philippines and spent 2 years in a Japanese work camp. So I wear this flag in honor of him every day. My father, at age 18, graduated from high school, was drafted into the United States Army, where he served his country in Vietnam. Came home, got a job with the phone company, the old Ohio Bell, before he got his CDL, and worked the rest of his days as a school bus driver for Columbus Public Schools. So my path to the bench was always one that involved hard work and a lot of grit. I worked my way through Bowling Green State University to get my criminal justice degree, then on to Ohio State University College of Law. After my first year of OSU Law School, I obtained an exclusive internship working in Washington, D.C. with the Federal Bureau of Investigation. I worked at the FBI headquarters, where I had the opportunity to work with agents and attorneys there to help advise all the field offices and their agents about certain Fourth Amendment search and seizure issues. Then during my second year of law school, that's when I began a clerkship, an internship with the Franklin County Prosecutor's Office. And that's when I fell in love with the courtroom. I had the opportunity to work with some amazing attorneys. Our former United States Attorney, David DeVillers, was a young assistant prosecutor who headed up our gang unit at that time. But I felt particularly sort of attached to a group of lawyers who specialized in crimes of violence against women and children, called the Special Victims Unit, like the television show. This unit prosecuted child abuse cases, human trafficking, sexual assault, homicide cases, really important, really difficult cases. So shortly after graduating, Ron O'Brien, the elected prosecutor, put me in that unit as one of the assistant prosecutors, and 18 months later, he put me in charge of that unit. So I'm only a couple years out of law school, and I'm handling some of the most difficult and, to be blunt, high-profile cases that an elected prosecutor handles. But I really thrived, and I enjoyed the work. It was difficult work. It also involved a lot of training of lawyers, judges, doctors, nurses. And at one point, David DeVillers, who was then, at this point, with the U.S. Attorney's Office, was a special envoy overseas at in Georgia, the former Soviet Republic. He and the Department of Justice invited me to travel to Georgia, to Tbilisi, Georgia, to help train some of their lawmakers and prosecutors about dealing with issues such as domestic violence and child abuse cases. So it was a tremendous honor. I've been a judge now for 11 years. I started off in the municipal court, Franklin County Municipal Court, before now my current job on the Common Pleas General Division. So as a judge, I've over the years, I believe I've garnered a reputation for being fair and impartial, a hard worker, treat people with respect, all parties with respect. And a lot about a trial court does is make difficult decisions. You know, trial court judges have to make decisions every day, often on a split second. And it's a great work, and I love the work. I believe as a judge, it's important to provide consistency and stability in the law. At times, that means following a law or a court precedent that I might not necessarily personally agree with, but recognizing that my job is to say what the law is, not what the law should be. I'm also greatly concerned with public safety. I'm married with three kids, and I want my kids and my grandkids to grow up in an Ohio that is safe and free. Our government has a duty to protect law-abiding citizens, and a judge's job is to uphold the Constitution and the rule of law. I've always, on a final note, practiced and preached the importance of giving back in civic education. Judges shouldn't hide behind judicial canons and wall themselves off from the public. I've always spent my time giving back, whether it's talking to different community groups, neighborhood block watches, or even our youth. Judge Jiza Page, colleague at the Kamala Police Court, a Democrat, and I every summer run what's called a Justice for All Youth Summer Camp, where we take youth from across the county, bring them down to the courthouse, teach them about the law, have a great mock trial, and it's always a wonderful event. So again, I'm getting the stop sign, but thank you very much. Again, my name is Judge Dan Hawkins. I really look forward to answering your questions and being part of this panel today. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for inviting me to be here today. And thank you to the members of the society who have put this great event on, and also to Professor Walker for agreeing to be here and spend time with us. As some of you may know, I'm currently a trial court judge down in Hamilton County Court of Common Pleas. So it's not every day that we get these opportunities to step out from behind the bench and chat like this with folks. So this is truly my pleasure. I know we do have a lot of folks here that we want to get questions from you, the audience, as well as from professors. So I'm going to keep this fairly short, but for the record, is that real life short or closing argument short? I'm going to go with closing argument short. Okay, let's proceed. Here's a little bit more about my background, or a little bit about my background. I'm the youngest of eight kids. We were all born within a 12-year period, and my mother became a single parent with only a high school education when I was still very young, and all eight of us were in that house, and she was solely responsible for us. To say my path to the bench was not predetermined would be an understatement. Fortunately, my mother, and to know her is to fear her, she required much of us, education-wise, so that we would never find ourselves in the situation that she found herself in. So I put myself through college at Kent State University and then law school at the University of Cincinnati. I then worked for the Butler County Prosecutor's Office for 5 years and then for Justice Dieters in the Hamilton County Prosecutor's Office for another 6. My journey has taken me from being an assistant prosecutor, where I was in the thick of the fight for justice and standing up for victims, all the way to the municipal court bench, where I spent 4 years in Hamilton County, and then on to the Common Pleas bench in 2015, which is where I serve now. Ladies and gentlemen, I appreciate the Federalist Society and what it stands for. A group of conservatives and libertarians interested in the current state of the legal order. It is founded on the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental powers is central to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and the duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what the law should be. You all know these words. It's the heart of the Federalist Society. But you also know I am not a federal judge. I am an elected judge. Thus, I am expected and welcome the opportunity to participate in the political system, yet embrace the intent and mission of the Federalist Society, because I believe that every judge, elected or appointed, federal or state, should adhere to that province. Each Supreme Court justice has a unique path, and I'd be proud, if elected, to take my trial court experience to the Supreme Court bench. That's because I think we're at a pretty interesting point in Ohio's history and our country's legal history. The Ohio Supreme Court has had a huge role always, but there are divergent paths. Will the court be committed to applying the law and our state constitution to protect liberty and the rule of law? Or will it be used as what I would call a weapon, making law and putting a thumb on the scale of justice to promote an agenda? I know where I stand. I am a candidate for justice, not legislator. That's why groups like the Federalist Society are so important. You play a huge part in shaping how the public and judges read about the law and think about the courts, focusing on the importance of an original understanding of the Constitution and the role of checks and balances. About 2 years ago, we saw a great example highlighting the different judicial philosophies. You'll surely remember that in 2022, the Ohio Supreme Court released an opinion that said trial judges like me couldn't consider certain things like public safety when setting the amount of bail for people arrested for violent crimes like rape or murder. I respect and follow all of the Supreme Court's decisions, even if I don't like them personally. I was thrilled to see a grassroots movement develop and the General Assembly agree to put a constitutional amendment on the ballot for bail reform, and I used my platform to advocate for the safety of my community. I testified at the State House, I wrote op-eds, and I talked to the public about their vote and what it could do. Nearly 80% of our Ohio citizens spoke clearly and overruled that Supreme Court opinion. Now I am ready for the next step up to the Ohio Supreme Court, where I'll dedicate the next several decades to not only protecting the Constitution, but ensuring Ohio remains a beacon of safety, freedom, and fairness for businesses, our families, and the next generation. I aim to be the kind of justice who always leans on the fundamental principles of justice and the rule of law in every decision. It is about doing the court's job to follow the law, not make it, keeping Ohio a place where justice is seen and felt and not just talked about. Thank you for allowing me to be here today. I appreciate your time.
Madam Timekeeper, I think she didn't use all her time, so if I can use hers. Good morning, everyone. My name is Melody Stewart. I am entering the 18th year as a juris in this state, and thank you for having us again at your conference to hear this robust discussion about the Constitution. I have had the pleasure of serving as a justice on the court, elected in 2018, and prior to that, 12 years on the 8th District Court of Appeals in Cuyahoga County. Before that, in my 35 years as a lawyer, I started off doing civil defense litigation and then spent a considerable amount of time in academe. I've had the privilege of working for 3 of our 9 Ohio law schools, and I'm a native Ohioan myself. So I spent time as an assistant dean and law professor. And speaking of law professor, I'm probably the only panelist in this room on this dais whose law professor is sitting in the room. So hopefully I won't get a question about, you know, some of the things that we debated. it has been an honor and privilege to serve on the court. So I went to undergraduate school at the College Conservatory of Music at the University of Cincinnati, because with the name Melody, what else would I study in undergraduate school, right? So I'm a classically trained pianist, majoring in theory and composition. And then I went on to work for a healthcare management company, because back in the 80s when I went to school, I didn't necessarily tie getting a degree to being employed. So I promptly took that music degree and got a job in the healthcare industry and was intellectually bored after a year. Ended up going to law school and then later going on to get a doctorate, a PhD in social sciences. And doing that, and I defended that dissertation while on the bench, while a judge, taught me how to ask the right questions. Serving 12 years on the appellate court, it's interesting to say what my judicial philosophy is, but I think I have enough written work out there that you can discern for yourself. Judge Forbes talked about in the beautiful courtroom, main courtroom at the 8th District, that above that bench are the words, we are a society of law, not men. Really, it said laws. But during my time there, the way that S at the end of laws was situated, there was a pillar. And so it looked like it says, we are a society of law, snot men. So we decided, let's just erase that S, and so it looks better. And so just a tidbit. So next time you're in the 8th District Court of Appeals in the main courtroom, you go look for that deleted S. You know, to say that my path, that's, you know, so I'm Justice 161, the 161st Justice on our court. I was only the 12th of 13 women to have served on the court. And then, of course, the first African-American woman to be elected to the court, which is a path that was unheard of, as you heard someone else say about their path, I think Judge Shanahan. I was raised by a single mother who was born and raised in the South, where education only went to the 8th grade for children of color, for African-American children. And so she was one of 11. You grew up, you came up South, you lived with a sibling, and you got a job. And so I was surprised to see, after my mother passed and after I graduated from college, that she got her GED when she was in her 60s. Now, I shouldn't have been surprised because I knew she only had an 8th grade education, but my mother was well-read. And so she worked overtime at the post office to make extra money for me to go to an all-girls private college prep school, Catholic high school, and for me to go to the Cleveland Music School settlement so I can learn theory and playing the piano. And she taught me to play Scrabble when I was 8 years old. And I didn't beat her until I got to college. And she taught me to read the ticker tape symbols in the newspaper so that I understood what the stock market was going into high school. It was those things and those challenges that without question, put me where I am now. Unfortunately, my mother never even got a chance to vote for me at any point in life. She died the morning after my first fundraiser when I ran for judge in 2000. And so although she doesn't get to see this, I spend every day as an elected official, as a jurist on our court, doing things that she would be very proud to see me do. So I look forward to this dynamic discussion. I say I only have about a minute left, but I thank you all for being here, and I look forward to some of your questions. Thank you.
All right, well, that was fun. So let's jump into questions. And I've got, as I mentioned, I've got one for each candidate, but then after the first person answers it, I'll kind of go to that line. If anyone else wants to answer it, they can as well. And I hope you do. Not you don't have to answer every question, but I really hope this is more of a discussion. So the first question I have is for Judge Hawkins, and these were just randomly assigned. I'm going to start with Chief Judge Jeff Sutton's book, 51 Imperfect Solutions. So Judge Sutton has argued that state Supreme Court should not necessarily interpret their state constitutions in lockstep with how the U.S. Supreme Court interprets the U.S., the federal constitution. And I kind of wonder, do you agree with that? And maybe in particular, do you think that the Equal Protection Clause in the Ohio Constitution should be interpreted in lockstep with the way the U.S. Supreme Court has interpreted that similar provision in the federal constitution?
Sure. Thanks for the question. I'm actually excited to get this question because I mentioned being a graduate of Ohio State University College of Law, and I actually, during my time here, my third year, I took a course called Supreme Court Litigation that was taught by Chief Judge Sutton a couple years before he took the bench. So that being said, I think he taught me well because I do agree with him. I don't think if you believe in federalism and the idea that You know, the idea of the laboratories of democracy, that you don't blindly follow the United States Supreme Court when it comes to the Ohio Constitution. You should respect the Ohio Constitution, give it its own due weight, and that, you know, the Ohio Court, the House Constitution deserves its own independent analysis. And when it comes to the Equal Protection Clause, I haven't given much thought about that. I guess I would say I don't think so. I think, again, the language is different between the amendments. I think you look to the federal constitution as sort of guidance, but not necessarily dispositive. I think if we're going to agree on these, as he said, the 51 imperfect solutions rather than one imperfect solution, the Ohio Supreme Court, the Ohio Constitution should really deserve its own independent analysis.
Want to do? So want to maybe go to, yeah, let's go down the line and see. Judge Shanahan, do you have anything that you want to, any reactions or?
I agree. I think it's interesting to note, just a trivia fact, that the Ohio Constitution has over 67,000 words. The U.S. Constitution has 7,591 words. That alone should tell you that you cannot treat these documents as if they are the exact same document. But even going through and reading each provision, there are so many differences. And what we have to rely upon and what we should expect are the litigators, the advocates, to do the heavy lifting and show why it is that there is this difference and why the interpretation should be different. To just jump in and go lockstep with the United States Constitution merely makes us rubber stamps.
Just want to jump.
No, I'm fine.
Yeah, Justice Donnelly. Sure. Yeah,
I would echo everything that was said. I'm a big fan of Judge Sutton. I have participated in a state constitution seminar every year that he usually attends, along with Dean Steinglass, one of the foremost state constitutional experts in the state. And I really enjoyed talking about it. It's well established that the Ohio Constitution is a document of independent force. And I recently joined a concurring opinion of my colleague Justice Fisher and Justice Dieters, which encouraged attorneys to make more arguments based on the Ohio Constitution, because although if the language is the same, there may be a strong argument that we should, in those situations, follow in lockstep, so to say, speak. We should also not close ourselves to arguments that, even if the language is the same, that there may be solid arguments, persuasive arguments, that they shouldn't be. And with the regards to the equal protection, I think that there is, it is different in its language with the federal constitution. It existed for a long time in the state of Ohio, and so judges should never foreclose arguments based on the Ohio Constitution. And we have, in conference, lamented the fact that people had opportunities to make arguments and they didn't do so.
Do you want to jump
in,
Justice?
Well, I liked Judge Sutton's comparison to when you have two foul shots and you only need one to win the game, you still take both shots. I think that's apt. And as Justice Donnelly said, I think many times both constitutions aren't argued and they should be.
Well, I'll just hop in and wrap it up that, you know, I think it is a very interesting question because so often, as in particular appellate court judges, but all judges, you know, we get the case that's brought to us. And, you know, one thing that's particularly interesting is you raised in the question about the Equal Protection Clause. Arguably, the Ohio Constitution is written as an affirmative obligation on the part of the government to afford equal protection to the people of the state of Ohio, whereas in the federal constitution, it's a prohibition that the state shall not deny equal protection. And I think those are an important consideration, or important considerations, but we also have an abundance of Supreme Court authority that guides us and informs us that we are to, that the equal protection clauses of both the federal and the state constitution require individuals to be treated in a manner similar to others in like circumstances, and that does indeed get lumped together. And so I think it's an interesting question, I think, for all of us to pay attention to and look forward to going forward as the issue gets raised.
Great. So the second question is on stare decisis, and this was for Justice Donnelly to kick us off. There's been a lot of debate about stare decisis lately at the federal level, and I think at the state level as well. And I wanted to go to Justice Thomas on the U.S. Supreme Court, who said, "In my view, if a court encounters a decision that is demonstrably erroneous, in particular one that is not a permissible interpretation of the text, the court should correct the error regardless of whether other factors support overruling the precedent." And I kind of wonder, do you agree or disagree with Justice Thomas's view? And if you disagree, I'd love to hear a little bit more about each of your approaches to stare decisis. And obviously, we're talking about here on the Ohio Supreme Court. Yeah.
Thank you. The short answer to whether I agree with Justice Thomas's view, should decisions in the past that were wrongly decided clearly be overturned? Yes, I do. If someone would ask me, what do you love about the law so much? I would say, both as a former trial court judge and now as a Supreme Court justice, what I love about the law is the guidance that it provides me in my decision-making process, even if that guidance leads me to a result that I don't like. So I think the concept of stare decisis is a very important one. I don't go looking for cases to overturn. I would much rather have that issue raised by the parties, either in a jurisdictional motion that says we should revisit, and I voted for plenty of cases where they've asked us to revisit prior Ohio Supreme Court precedent. But that's what I appreciate. There's two cases that I can think of that I authored that were 7-0 decisions, State versus Bertram, and State versus Bortry, that involved results that I did not like. It involved people that, because of our decision, escaped accountability for criminal behavior. But as all of my colleagues on both of those decisions agreed, the law is the law, and we must follow it, regardless of the results. So that's my philosophy about overturning arguments. I'm very careful and cautious before I consider that, and I don't go looking for that opportunity. I'd rather have it come to the court and raised by the advocates.
Anyone else want to jump in on this one? Let's go down to Justice Stewart.
I think obviously, stare decisis is not a statutory or a constitutional mandate. It's a doctrine that we use in the judiciary, and I think there needs to be strong reason or strong grounds to do so. I mean, we shouldn't just overturn precedent because we didn't like it or we thought it was decided wrongly. As you stated, with Justice Thomas is saying, is something that's demonstrably erroneous. And those who've sat on appellate courts know that even when you have dissents, there are justices and judges who feel or who interpret things differently. That's not demonstrably erroneous to me. Demonstrably erroneous is if, for instance, a statute said, shall not travel down Main Street with a blue hat, and someone has on a green hat, you know, and so it's, the question is what constitutes demonstrable error, and then even if it was demonstrably erroneous, does it need to be overturned? So for instance, has the law evolved such that the application won't matter anymore, either because of statute, not obviously abrogation by statute, but because there's been some statutory changes in the law that makes the outcome the same regardless. And so I am cautious to do that, because then it seems that it's either personal whims or some other non-judicial whims that motivate changing the law. And then I think it adds to uncertainty in litigation, obviously.
Others want to jump in?
I would jump in just to say, and maybe this is wearing my Court of Appeals judge hat, but the Ohio Supreme Court has told us when we're when we should look to and consider overturning prior precedent, or when they should look to overturning prior precedent. And that test does include more than simply, as Justice Stewart was just articulating, more than just a personal assessment that the prior decision is clearly erroneous. And so I think that because we do have an added layer of guidance here from our very own Ohio Supreme Court, certainly, if something is demonstrably erroneous, it certainly should be looked at to be revisited. But we have other considerations. That's from the Galatas case.
Judge Shanahan, did you want to jump in?
I would say that, I absolutely believe with or agree with Justice Thomas that, we take an oath to the Constitution, not stare decisis. And when it's wrong, it has to be overturned, with the understanding that, much like the insurance case, the Galatas case, we've been given these parameters, which is important as well, because without that, you still then have the whim of the court. So it's good to have these working parameters, and cases should be considered within those parameters.
Anyone else want to jump in?
I agree with the rest of the panel, really. I think if it is demonstrably erroneous, it should be overturned. Take an oath to the Constitution. But you need to be careful to make sure we're not turnover happy. The law shouldn't necessarily be dependent upon the makeup of the court that particular year. So I think it has to be something that's overwhelmingly demonstrably erroneous. And I think the court does have a duty to overturn that.
Awesome. Well, let's jump to the third question then, on interpretive methodology, and this one is for Judge Forbes. I'm stealing this question from Robert Alt's one a couple years ago that was just, it felt like a law school exam, but we might kind of rework it a bit. So I am curious, like, what types of sources should a judge consider when interpreting novel legislation? And Robert gave us a list of sources that he asked to rank. In 2 minutes, I'm not sure you could rank them all, but I'm really curious about, I mean, I'm a list of sources, and I'm curious, like, if others want to jump on, but just kind of the idea of, like, where does the judge start? Where does the judge stop? What things are in bounds? What things are out of bounds? So let me kind of give the list. Non-binding authority from other courts, statements from the legislative sponsor of the bill explaining the purpose of the law. This really is, Robert, like my law school exams in Ligre. Section by section summary by the Legislative Service Commission, the text of the law, dictionaries, canons of interpretation, on-point scientific studies addressing the impact of the law, a public statement signed by over 100 officials working in the Ohio agency that enforces the law, and last but not least, we got to have the economists in here, a report by economists assessing the economic impact of the law. So again, you don't have to talk about all of this, but just really kind of what is, like, your vision for that, and, like, what things are in, what things are out, if that makes sense.
Sure. I can tell you that interpreting statutes is something that happens all the time at the Court of Appeals, as I'm sure you all know. The first place and only place to start is with the text. But even before you look at the text, or I should say even before I look at the text, I always make sure that I understand the facts and circumstances of the case, and then I read the statute. I never bring a predetermined agenda or idea about what the outcome should be, because that's not my job. That's not the job of a judge. My job is to look at the language of the statute, and the first question I must answer is the statute ambiguous? If it's not ambiguous, it must be applied. Doesn't matter whether I like it or don't like it. It is what it is. If it is ambiguous, then the question is, how do we decide how to resolve the ambiguity? And I can't pass up the opportunity to point out one of the great conundrums, I guess, that is presented by the notion that it's the unique province of the judiciary to say what the law is, right? That's Marbury versus Madison. I don't think anybody disputes that proposition. But we have a legislative enactment that tells us how we're supposed to review ambiguous statutes, and our job is to follow unambiguous statutes, but it's our job to say how to interpret laws. So how do we resolve this? What are we supposed to do? And I think for me, I look at the statute regarding resolution of ambiguous statutes as important and interesting guidance. And that says that what we look at, again, is the text first and foremost. And many, many, indeed most, I think, of the questions that I've confronted so far as a judge have been resolvable by looking at the statute in its totality. But then, you know, then you do have to look at if there's a term that's not defined by the statute, you go to a dictionary. If it's not, if that doesn't resolve the question, then I may go to legislative history to try to understand how did this change in the law come to pass. I may look at past versions of the statute to understand what, in fact, was the change. What did it change from, so that I can understand what is new and why is it new. That might help to resolve. That's all the types of things that I do, in fact, look at. Some of these, I'm not sure how they would even come into play. I don't know how I would even have a report of economists before me or a public statement, because I'm limited to the four corners of the record, so I'm not entirely sure where those come into play, but maybe in an interesting intellectual discussion.
Well, as a law professor, I get asked to sign on those briefs all the time. Somehow they get through amicus. But all right, I think Justice Donnelly wanted to jump in on this one. Just Stuart as well.
Yeah, so Justice Donnelly. Sure, I would reiterate that my analysis always begins with the text. If it's unambiguous and it resolves the dispute in front of us, that's where the inquiry ends. But do not discount the importance of the dictionary. And I want to give you an example of that. This case I mentioned earlier, State v. Bertram, involved the victim of a crime was mowing his lawn, and the defendant in this case pulled up in front while he was mowing the lawn, got out of his car, walked up the driveway, smiled at the victim, walked into his open garage, picked up a new leaf blower that he had just bought, still in the box, walked down, put it back in his car, and drove away. And the victim called the police, and he was charged with burglary. Now, in Ohio, the law about burglary is very clear. You have to prove, if you're the state, that someone entered someone's residence by force, stealth, or deception in order to hold someone accountable. And I thought, wow, he didn't use any force. He very blatantly went into this garage and stole this. And I wonder how the Court of Appeals 3-0 affirmed this decision. So I read their analysis, and they said the stealth element was met by his cavalier attitude as he walked up the driveway. So I took out the dictionary, and I said, you know, cavalier seems to be the opposite. So that decision came in 4-3, just one vote. One of Justice Dieter's first arguments that we heard, and we reversed that decision 7-0, because again, the law is the law.
Okay. Justice Stewart?
I ditto what all my colleagues here have said. My problem arises particularly in a statute when it's an amendment to a statute. Classic example is a case we decided, I think either this year or earlier last year, Diller versus Diller, dealing with whether a primary device lapses. And the General Assembly changed the law to include, add a certain device that doesn't lapse. And the General Assembly said device means, and it listed these things and did not have the word primary device in there. Now, the history, a whole history of the legislation on wills and on trust and dealing with primary devices when the decedent passes before, or advised to a will passes before the decedent. And It was all very, very clear that a primary device, this legislation was designed so that a primary device doesn't lapse. Well, when the amendment happened, they put include, the General Assembly included the word means instead of includes, and so the case had a primary device lapse. It, there was no document, no historical background, no discussions on the floor, no prior case law, nothing that indicated the General Assembly intended that. So in my mind, that was clearly a clerical error or Scrivener's error, as evidenced by the fact that as soon as this case came out of the appellate court, the General Assembly quickly changed the word means to includes. But that's where I thought you can't be devoid of common sense. And all of this wasn't substituting my judgment, but I think to follow that mistake says, oh, well, the General Assembly made a mistake, so somebody's got to suffer for that mistake, when all the law indicated that that was not intended. So I agree with all the plain language analysis that we follow, but when things are amended and appears that there is a mistake, I think common sense should prevail. Well, I was the dissent in that case.
Awesome. All right, Justice Dieters.
Just as a footnote to Justice Donnelly's fact pattern he gave you to tell you how diverse Ohio is, it was one of my first cases, and I come from a county where murder, unfortunately, is routine, and I've prosecuted 5 serial killers, and that fact pattern came up, and I said in oral argument, I know this isn't relevant, but where's your client right now? Oh, he's serving 5 years in the penitentiary right now. I was like, whoa. Do you remember?
Mm-hmm.
And but to get to your specific question, obviously, text, dictionary, canons of interpretation. I find almost all the other items out there that were enumerated misleading at best. You know, it's going down that path is very dangerous because many of these people, even the people that the sponsors of the bill, they don't know what these notes say. You know, some kid in college wrote them or something. So I don't give much value to that. Thanks.
Anyone else want to jump in? Or okay, so I think Judge Shanahan, you have the next one, the originalism question. Okay,
I do.
Good. All right, so now let's talk about constitutional interpretation. And I want to ask, when it comes to constitutional interpretation, would you consider yourself an originalist? And in particular, kind of a question I'm just interested in is, if you are originalist, even if you're not, like, how might you approach interpreting the original provisions of the Ohio Constitution the same or differently than voter-enacted provisions of the Ohio Constitution?
I absolutely am an originalist. That's an easy one to answer. As far as the wording, I would not divide them into two categories. The wording adopted by the people of Ohio as amendments to the original Constitution are the Constitution. And you simply follow the law, follow the Constitution. What do the words say? So I would not treat or divide the two into separate categories and give one more or less deference than the other.
Others want to jump in?
I agree with that last part. I mean, they when it comes to voter enacted provisions, you're not able to read the mind of how many hundreds of thousands of Ohioans and their reasoning for voting for a particular amendment or not. So I think giving it the same analysis as the rest of the Constitution makes most sense. And I'd agree to the extent a trial court judge can label him or herself an originalist versus anything else. I think my time in the court, I've dedicated myself to just following the plain language of the law and going along that route.
I feel the same way. I don't like to pigeonhole myself into one, but do I value originalist thought? Yes, I do. We had a case up at the Ohio Supreme Court, which we asked the parties to send out for additional briefing. It involved the issue of whether someone accused of a crime, just simply indicted, whether that could act as a disability for someone to prohibit them from exercising their Second Amendment right to carry a gun. And the Supreme Court had, in an opinion issued by Justice Thomas, to me, had just issued an opinion with originalist analysis that I found very persuasive, and I thought it maybe resolved the case, and my colleagues wanted it sent back down to the lower courts. I wrote a dissent in that case because I thought the opinion was pretty clear in resolving that case. But do I value originalist analysis? Yes.
And I would agree with that. That I certainly it is interesting. But when you talk about the Ohio Constitution and its 173 amendments, it's hard to say that we should go back to 1851 to really understand what the Constitution means, because the Constitution embodies all, not only the original provisions, but all 173 amendments as well. And so I think the amendments have to inform any analysis and application.
Anyone else? Okay, well then we'll turn to Justice Stewart on a question on criminal law. The Ohio Supreme Court recently upheld the imposition of consecutive prison terms under Ohio law. And just curious, like, how should the courts review these cases now, and how searching should judges be when evaluating consecutive sentences?
Well, I don't know how recent it's been in my history. The Supreme Court has, for quite some time, upheld consecutive sentencing. I mean, it is a law in the state. But we recently had at least some back and forth on a case that dealt with consecutive sentencing, an original opinion that where I was initially the author, then got overturned when our court changed. And so that law, it was only good for 2 minutes, that basically said judges should need to, or the statute allows judges to look at an aggregate sentence when dealing with consecutive sentence. The legislature has made clear that judges have the discretion to impose sentences consecutively if certain factors are met. And that was a case where a woman was sentenced for thefts. Many of you probably know about it, heard in the newspaper, of stealing personal items from very vulnerable population in nursing homes. Most of them were discovered in her basement, and her lawyer asked for probation. She pled guilty. She was remorseful. The prosecutor asked, I think, for about 20 or 25 years. Well, the judge sentenced her to 65 years in prison, and she was 55 years old at the time, never having been convicted of a crime. And so that sentence may have still been imposed. After coming up back and forth to our court several times, the original opinion went back and said that a trial court does need to look at the aggregate amount of sentencing. In our system, sentencing for trial court judges have two major components: protect the public and punish the offender. And protect the public should be first. Now, these, again, were theft crimes, and they were, I think some of them were categorized as robbery because she did enter into the room of people in the nursing home and assisted living. And so 65 years at age 55, no chance for parole. I guess that clearly protects the public because she will likely die in prison. But I think the question, there is no guidance in the statute for after, when you found that consecutive sentences are necessary to protect the public, a single sentence won't be adequate. When the trial court judge makes all those findings, does he or she have to stop? And our opinion said, no, the court doesn't have to. And that was overturned, reversed, and said, well, the statute doesn't say that you have to look at the aggregate or anything else. But I think, you know, we as judges are part of a bigger system here in our government. I mean, there is the Department of Rehabilitation and Corrections. I mean, do we need to have people incarcerated well past their time of being a danger to the public? We have to look at factors of over-incarceration and the toll that we're putting on the strain of the system, and particularly for nonviolent offenders. So I, again, with common sense, within the confines of what we're supposed to do, I believe the original decision was giving trial court judges another avenue of examination of these issues. Now, it may have been that we sent it back and the same exact opinion came up, or the same exact sentence was imposed, but at least that gave the trial court the tools, particularly in this case where the appellate court mentioned several times thinking that the sentence was excessive. You know, there is no mechanism to say this is excessive, so we're going to change it. But the analysis we put forth would have given courts opportunity to do so, but that's no longer the law.
All right, Justice Donnelly.
Ohio law mandates in 29-29-11 that trial court judges are to treat similarly situated defendants with similar sentences, regardless of the color of their skin, their socioeconomic place in society. But unfortunately, in the Ohio system, there's really no way to carry out this mandate because of the lack of data in the system. I've been one of the most vocal proponents of creating a criminal sentencing database, which would allow advocates and judges to make more informed decisions and carry out those mandates. Public confidence is threatened when people begin to believe that the outcome of their criminal case, the sentencing outcome, is more dependent on the proclivities of the judge rather than the rule of law, which requires proportionality, fairness, and adherence to all those ideals that we want, public safety, rehabilitation, if that's necessary. And we have a system that lacks checks and balances. I see that my friend, 10th District Court Judge Phil Calabrese, is in the audience. He has had the benefit of sentencing people in the state courts and in the federal courts, and he'll tell you that it's like night and day because of the data that he has that's able to keep his sentences consistent, not only with himself, but with other judges. This is where I believe we have to move in order to have a sentencing scheme in Ohio that treats people more fairly, more equally.
Let's go to Judge Shanahan first and then Judge Hawkins. Yeah.
The revised code does dictate the possible length. And as a longtime trial judge, I always carefully consider the possible sentence for each defendant. Every single case is different, and I cannot stress that enough. I decide my cases and sentences based on a multitude of factors that go into determining the appropriateness, whether consecutive sentences are warranted, and many other things. A reviewing court should simply review for compliance with what is possible, not what it feels the sentence should be. What I do find is a very pressing issue that is in this realm, the criminal realm of this question, is the over-interference in the state system by federal judges and magistrates. Those federal court judges and magistrates act like Monday morning quarterbacks, and years or decades after convictions are trying to do what appears to many free guilty people, and do so in a way or at a time that would be virtually impossible, if not absolutely impossible, to retry the case. And those unelected interlopers are wreaking havoc on our justice system and the communities that they are releasing these dangerous defendants into.
Judge Hawkins?
I agree that the trial court, you know, surprisingly, should really have great deference in sentencing matters. The trial court judge is the closest to this situation. Appellate courts, they read a transcript and they have a record, but it's, you know, each sentencing hearing, if you haven't taken, you know, witnessed one or as a judge conducted one, it's very difficult, it's very individualized. The toughest of tough on crime judge, it's still difficult to look a man in the eye, just, you know, this kind of distance and say, you're going to prison. And I know your family and your kids are back there, but you're going to prison for 10 years. That's not easy to do. And I don't think sentencing judges take that lightly. Trial court judges, so long as they follow the law, there's specific purposes and principles of sentencing and sentencing factors you follow. But trial court judges, you know, they're elected as well. They're responsible to the public. They take the same oath as appellate judges and Supreme Court justices, and when it comes to consecutive sentences, you know, there's certain situations where it's appropriate, some where it's not. Certainly, I think that each offense, so long as it's appropriate, deserves its own penalty or sentencing. When I've imposed consecutive sentences, I've been known to say that our justice system shouldn't be like Costco. You don't get a discount because you commit crime in bulk. Each offense should deserve its own system. So I believe in great deference to the trial court in those matters because it is so individualized, each and every case, and it's something that I think trial court judges really don't take lightly.
Anyone else want to on this one? All right, well, I'll save my favorite question for last. It was randomly assigned to Justice Dieters. There's been a lot of discussion whether the U.S. Supreme Court should overrule Chevron versus NRDC. The kind of bedrock principle of federal administrative law that courts should defer to agencies' interpretations of statutes that are ambiguous so long as the agency's interpretation is reasonable. How would you approach deference to state agency legal interpretations, maybe in light of what the Supreme Court is saying about Chevron, but more importantly, in light of your view of the proper role of courts in administrative law?
I know you don't have a dog in this fight, Chris, but anyway.
I don't have a vote, so.
I understand. I think we spoke before. It was interesting to me. This issue, I was approached, not approached, but talked to three separate lawyers about this issue before this panel discussion. And I find it interesting to see how, before his death, how Justice Scalia was starting to move on the issue. But in Ohio, obviously, as you know, there's no mandatory deference involved. And we would consider the agency's interpretation based on its persuasive power concerning if it's a genuinely ambiguous rule. Not altering the clear text. I will say this, I did, I hope you don't mind, I did read your amicus brief that you filed in the Power case, and the one argument I found interesting, as I mentioned to you earlier, was the fact that that Chevron deference has been in effect for almost four decades, and Congress hasn't touched it. It may sound contrary to my prior statement that I don't trust legislative notes and reports like that, but that is a bit persuasive in my mind.
I would reiterate. I think regardless of what the U.S. Supreme Court does, the matter of administrative deference has been settled in the state of Ohio, and I joined my colleague. Justice Pat DeWine's well-reasoned opinion in TWISM, and we decided that we will review those cases de novo without providing any deference. So that's where I stand on the issue.
Right, and just the added little wrinkle there, that if it's a unique matter, that there's particular expertise, that we can learn something from the agency interpretation, well, then certainly we wouldn't be foreclosed the opportunity to consider that. But otherwise, it's settled question in Ohio.
Other thoughts?
I think it's a very much a settled question, thanks to Justice DeWine's well-reasoned argument and the unanimous verdict. One thing that I have to give a shout out to a friend in the room, who's a friend of yours as well, Professor Chip Miller, who still feels this was decided wrongly because partners, managers, members, officers, or directors is interpreted as a term of art and would only apply to the highest of corporate authority. So you need to talk with
Chip
Miller about whether he agrees, but this is well decided in Ohio. I understand why the federal folks are very interested in it, but it's something that's been put to bed for us.
So, well, let's go ahead and open it up to questions from the audience. We've got a mic here. It's being recorded, so let's use the mic. Oh, good, we've got, Lee's already up to.
Thanks so much for your thoughtful conversation. This actually piggybacks a little bit on Chris's last question. So all of you, I think, to one degree or another, committed yourself to judicial independence, to separation of powers. I think firewall was what Judge Forbes had described the Supreme Court as playing that role. And I wanted to know whether and to what degree you think that position is consistent with something else that I think this Ohio Supreme Court has been committed to, which is a presumption of constitutionality. So when a statute comes before you, the Ohio Supreme Court has said repeatedly for a long period of time that it comes with a thumb on the scale in favor of constitutionality. I think in the Dayton versus State case, you even said recently that the challenger has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that that statute is unconstitutional. So I wanted to see to what degree you thought that those two propositions, judicial independence, separation of powers, firewall, is committed with that deference that you all had identified in the past. Thank you.
Yes, I'll take that question first. I'm skeptical about a presumption of constitutionality. I mean, there's a reason we have three co-equal branches of government, and we're a system of checks and balances. And just like we were just talking about in the last question, I don't believe there's a lot of members of our legislature who are not attorneys. Sometimes they are passing legislation that have just been submitted to them by lobbyists. And why do we have to say, because that was voted on, that was presumed constitutional, and why don't we just review that and hear the arguments that they are or not?
Anyone else want to jump in?
I guess I would push back that many of our founders weren't attorneys, and that I think that the legislators take the same oath to uphold the Constitution as justices. Obviously, the court has the final say of the interpretation of the Ohio Constitution. But I do think that that deference should be given. Although, you know, obviously, do make a proper role as far as oversight and the co-equal branch of government.
Anyone else want to weigh in? It's a fun question. We actually got a disagreement too. All right, Robert, you're up.
Well, first, thank you all for coming today. Really appreciate your helping to enlighten us on how it is that you would approach questions of interpretation. If there is a consensus on the panel today, it seems to be that judges shouldn't be legislating from the bench. Help me to understand what, and the rest of the room to understand what that means. Could you give me an example, could be federal or state, of a case in which you believe a court legislated from the bench, and why is it you think they did so in that case? Thank you.
Awesome.
Question.
All right. I'll take this question. I don't like using that that accusation of legislating from the bench. When you're interpreting statutes and laws that are written in the English language, jurists in good faith can have disagreements as to what the meaning of those statutes are, whether this word should be interpreted broadly or negatively. And what I've always said to my clerks from day one is, I don't want to ever be accused of engaging in result-oriented analysis. And if they see that, we're all judges up here. We're all human beings. We all have our own personal biases, and so it's very important that we interrogate those biases and keep them in check and not let them contaminate the process. I remember we had a case, the Amazon case that came in which Amazon was accused of putting a defective product into the marketplace. And the statute said that if you help in any way supply that putting that product into the marketplace, you could be named as a supplier in a lawsuit to seek damages on that. And Amazon's argument was, we're just like a mall. And people come into our mall and they see products and we don't do anything other than that. But the plaintiffs in that case had developed a record that said, no, you're not exactly a mall. If you pay enough money, your product can find its way as a preferential product to be purchased in the algorithm that you use. So I struggled with that case, looking at the language. And even though I saw a pathway where I could dissent, I was convinced that it would be legislating from the bench, because the The truth is those laws were written in the 1980s at a time when they could never have contemplated what has become in terms of how we get our products. And so I joined the majority and sided with Amazon, but I thought it was important enough to write a concurring opinion to say to the legislature that maybe these laws that were written in the 1980s might benefit from some updating if you want to truly protect protect the citizens of Ohio. So that's one example. I'm not going to accuse my colleagues who, you know, take their oath just as seriously that's what they're doing.
Yeah, I like that example. I always thought it was my amicus brief in that case, the reason you voted that way, but I guess that's Justice Stewart.
I'm often perplexed by that term, legislate from the bench, because I think it's, frankly, political dog whistling that's often used by candidates of one party against the other. You know, and I try to think of what constitutes legislating from the bench. And I came up just now with this idea. If we had a statute that said vehicles shall not travel on Main Street between 6 o'clock and 7 o'clock, and that's all the statute said. Now, if we're interpreting the statute, if we decided to uphold some conviction for that, and we put in the fact that, well, the legislature really only meant, because there are a lot of Main Streets in Ohio, the actual word Main, that it applied to Main Avenue or Main Parkway, and that it had to be between 6 o'clock and 7 o'clock in the evening, p.m., the statute didn't say, but those are the things that make sense to apply the statute. I'm thinking that's legislating from the bench. We're adding a specific time. We're making it main streets or limiting it to certain named main streets. And, you know, is it ambiguous? Certainly it is, and we can do something for that. But if we added those terms, and that would be legislating from the bench. You know, short of that, if we're not adding words, I don't see how that constitutes legislate. I don't see what, I never understood what was meant by legislating for event. For legislating from the bench, and just thought it was mainly whistling.
All right, Justice Dieters.
Yeah, I can give you an example from my own practice as a prosecutor. We had a former justice on the Ohio Supreme Court who publicly announced he will never vote on a death penalty case. He finds it unconstitutional under the Eighth Amendment. And when they frame the Constitution, they talk about depriving somebody of life. I mean, this wasn't even considered part of the process in the Eighth Amendment, but the decision was made by hit this judge. I asked him to get off the cases. He wouldn't get off the cases, no matter what. And that is the clearest example to me of somebody who was, in fact, legislating from the bench.
With all due respect, and I disagree with Justice Dieters there, that's not legislating from the bench. That's just not following the law.
Interesting.
I would say that what I referenced in my opening regarding the public safety amendment, the DuBose case, was, in my opinion, legislating from the bench. Criminal rules required trial judges to consider public safety, and the Supreme Court said, you shall not consider public safety. To me, that's legislating from the bench. It was corrected in short order because of the efforts of the folks that got behind that constitutional amendment to command judges to consider public safety. But I would say that is an example of legislating from the bench.
I guess I'll go ahead and be a contrarian there for a minute and just say that, you know, I mean, the consideration of public safety occurs before the question of bail.
Exactly.
And so the question of whether somebody is eligible for bail addresses whether somebody is a danger to the public. And if they're a danger to the public, they're not eligible for bail. There's no amount of money that can be slapped on somebody if they are a mass murderer. They are not eligible for bail. So public safety, by my reading of DuBose, was the first consideration, and then the second question was, if eligible for bail. That's how I read DuBose.
And that's how DuBose is written. Thank you.
Agree to disagree.
Awesome. Well, we're going to give the last question to Nathan. Yeah.
So Ohio has a long history of Fourth Amendment jurisprudence, with including Terry and stop and frisk. Ohio also has its own analog to that, Article 1, Section 14. To anyone who wants to answer, what is your opinion on that being a source of independent protections for Ohio citizens' search and seizures rights? And if so, how should that be interpreted? What sources would you look to?
The law student stump question to end it. That was not a plan. I don't know how to answer that, but anyone want to jump in?
So, if the Fourth Amendment cases are interesting because it goes to what I said before in terms of men and women jurists can in good faith disagree about what is reasonable and what is not. That's a term that opens itself up to some degree of subjectivity. I have a friend who's a criminal defense attorney who has no problem criticizing me when he disagrees with one of my decisions, and it involved a police officer who was walking the beat in a parking lot, and someone came out and said, "Stop that lady, she's drunk." And then she walked away, and he didn't know who it was. It was the equivalent, the appellant argued, of an anonymous tip. And the police officer went over and stopped her and made some inquiries, and sure enough, she was drunk. And I wrote the opinion on that, and I thought that was reasonable. And my advocate friends thought it was completely unreasonable. And I thought, no, I don't think the Fourth Amendment requires the police officer to allow that woman to drive down the road and see what happens before the probable cause. So I hope that answers your question, but took a stab.
I'm told we have a little bit of time. I want to ask one last question. I'm just curious. I've been thinking about this a lot, and then maybe this is just the academic in the room, but obviously with federal judges, it's life tenure. You don't run for office. With a state judge, especially a state Supreme Court judge, this is the final word from the judiciary in the state, you do run for office. And I'm kind of just, I wonder how that affects your role that you run for office, and kind of maybe similar along those lines, if you want to jump into it, how do you feel about having party affiliations on when you do run for office? But and you don't have to answer, but I'm just curious the role that you see, the fact that you are elected by the people of Ohio when you serve in these capacities.
I'm 100% against having party affiliation on judges. There's arguments to be made about judicial selection, about the problems with elected judges. A lot of people vote because they have a nice Irish name like Donnelly or Shanahan, and they don't want to become informed about who the candidates are. But if we're going to have an elected judiciary, I think it should be completely nonpartisan, and that would instill in the public the knowledge of the independence of the judiciary. The press did a disservice, I think, during the redistricting cases when they would say questions like, Chief Justice Maureen O'Connor sided with the three Democrats, Well, I guess that's accurate, but it's not truthful, because we don't reach across the aisle in the judiciary. I don't say, hey, Chief, I'll drop my dissent in this case if you do. We don't do this kind of stuff. We looked at the facts of that case. We looked at the text. Some of our colleagues disagree with us, but we all arrived at our decision there independently, and that's how we made our decision. And I will continue to believe that, no matter what happens in this election, that we should run just as jurists, independent, and be an independent judiciary. We exist to resolve disputes. We should do it efficiently and eliminate systemic delay for all the litigators in this room. And we should protect the rights that are enshrined in our Constitution.
All right, Justice Stewart.
Yeah, just quickly, I agree. I don't think we should have partisan primaries. I don't think we should have party affiliation in general election. Party affiliation was put on the ballot for not all of our judges in the state, just some of our judges, the 7 on the Supreme Court and the 69 appellate court judges. The timing of it was such that it's obvious it was political. It was nonpartisan. It was not agreed with by the leadership of the Ohio Judicial Conference. judges, Democrat and Republican, oppose it. And so it's just another way to politicize our judiciary. There's a reason why we don't have any independent jurist in the state of Ohio. And I think as long as we continue to let our parties, predominantly the two major political parties, be operatives of the judiciary, we'll continue to get a very politicized judiciary.
Judge Forbes, you want to jump in?
I was just going to say, as I said in my opening remarks, I'm very concerned about the effect that this politicization of judges has on people's confidence in the entire justice system. So I think it's a very bad idea.
Anyone else? Yeah, it seems like, all right, just Judge Shanahan, yeah. We'll Judge Shanahan and then Judge Hawkins. Sure. Yeah.
We are elected. We just can't get around that. There is a portion of this involvement, this engagement, when you run for these judicial seats, you are engaging in political activity. Now, what that also means, when you take the oath, you leave politics at the door. It is that simple. It is that straightforward. But to pretend like we will have justices that run without any party backing whatsoever is just a fallacy. So the key here is that once you take the bench, once you take that oath, that you take an oath to the Constitution to apply the law as written in leaving politics outside the door. But we cannot pretend that we are running for these. It is a political race.
Yeah, so party affiliation should be for all judges across the state.
I'm not going to take a position on that. I'm very comfortable with the fact that
because you are a judge there. Yeah. Yeah, Judge Hawkins.
No, I mean, I think it provides the voters with additional information. Prior to the party designation, the running joke was you should put O in front of your name, Judge Hawkins, and run as Judge O. Hawkins or have an Irish-sounding name. And I don't think that's necessarily the best route to go. When it comes to Republican versus Democrat justices, the pendulum's always going to swing both ways. You know, one year it'll help Republicans. 2 years down the road, it will help Democrats. At the end of the day, I think, and Justice Donnelly pointed this out, we have four Republicans, endorsed Republicans, three endorsed Democrats on the Ohio Supreme Court right now, but we don't have all three decisions coming out of the court. The judges all obviously take an oath to the Constitution, and they don't rule along quote-unquote party lines the whole time. So I think, and if you look at the races in 2020 versus the races in 2022, The voter drop-off practically disappeared. In 2020, I think, I forget the numbers, but there was a substantial percentage of drop-off between those who voted for president and those who voted in those two important Supreme Court races. That drop-off virtually disappeared in 2022 because at least it gives voters information, but at the end of the day, I'm just going to play the game by the rules as given, and I'll continue to go out there and meet as many folks as possible and show that whether it's Republican or Democrat, yeah, I'm a Republican who's been in elected three times in Franklin County, you know, the probably the most bluest county in the state. And I've done that because I've earned a reputation amongst my Republican and Democrat friends of being not an ideologue, but someone who just does the best job they can, works hard, and shows up to work every day trying to do the best job they can.
This is great. So we should probably have this as a separate panel next year. I'll take credit for that random question that ran into my mind. But thank you so much for being here. I know you're super busy. And thank you so much for serving the state of Ohio.